Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg, together with
Pat Schlarbaum
and Rebecca Brown.
And hello to you, the listener. Usually we start local talk shows with a pre-recorded segment from Pat Schlarbaum from the Department of Natural Resources, but today, Pat, you're here with us in person. So let's talk phenology, Pat. Okay. Who are we covering today?
Today, let's cover some of the peregrine falcon activities around the state.
Weren't the falcons originally considered extinct?
Well, DDT dramatically wiped them out from the Missouri River to the East Coast. They were no longer nesting in Iowa after about 1964.
So they've come back?
There was quite an effort that was initiated in 1982, and Iowa fell along with that activity in 1989, and we released 50 birds in Cedar Rapids, Des Moines, and Muscatine. And from those activities, we had nesting pairs initiated in 1993 in Des Moines.
So falcons are in Des Moines now?
And once again, they've returned. The story is quite a chapter in the recovery of a once-endangered species. They are no longer endangered. But
how did you first realize there were falcons back in Des Moines?
There was a construction crew right there working on site on the east side of the building. And in 2003, there was I noted a falcon and went up and talked to the construction foreman. His name is Kurt Small for Newman Brothers. And this was pretty critical because they were doing some refurbishment work at the Capitol. And I went up, knocked on the door, and said, how long has that falcon been kicking at you like this? And he said, is that what that is? The other day, a pigeon flew across the parking lot, and it big poof of feathers, and I wondered what that was. And how long has it been here? And it was in October of that year.
Pat, is it true that the falcon is kind of considered the top of the line when it comes to raptors, birds of prey?
Yeah, that's a real good point. Peregrine and our eagles occupy the top of that pyramid.
And why is that?
Peregrines do rely on other birds for their protein.
So you're saying the peregrine falcon is the one that eats the most birds? There's nobody above the falcon falcons?
Yeah, exactly. And that was kind of that played into their demise when DDT was being used. Everything that happened in the food chain ultimately affected those peregrine falcons. And when they became lost as a nesting species, that was the red flag that something's amiss in the environment. So they were the keystone species that indicated something was amiss, and it was determined that it was the DDT.
Falcons have been traditionally kind of associated with nobility, with hunting, with castles. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's quite amazing that this whole art of falconry initiated in the medieval times in the 1400s, and that peregrine falcons in Europe were attracted to the large castles on the hill.
Why was that?
And, you know, there's a lot of nooks and crannies, and who knows? They go where they want to be. And those large structures on top of the hill, there's updrafts, and apparently it has a lot to do with their interest in locating where they can have ledges in little nooks and alcoves, because they're a rock hawk. They were in the cliffs of northeast Iowa. They were not in cities. But we got them started in the cities, and it was pretty exciting when a bird showed up. And then she did not wander. Peregrine means wanderer in Latin. But this bird came to the Capitol in 2003, and in 2008 was paired up with a male and produced young.
In other words, the falcon essentially found Des Moines' equivalent of a castle and made a nest in the state capital.
In that regard, very, very good metaphor.
And isn't it true that the capital was just renovated?
Yeah, it was going through the refurbishment with the Newman Brothers. And so having their assistance, we were able to prepare a ledge. Typically, the water is always shunted away from the building on these ledges, so the eggs would roll off because they don't bring up any nesting material. They just nest in the detritus. So we were able to put a 4-inch board with some pea gravel, with the help of Newman Brothers, once again, and they successfully nested. But the dramatic turn of events that occurred last summer, the male was injured, and that male died, and there was no replacement male, and there were still three young in the nest. The female was able to successfully fledge those young. So all summer and then autumn and winter, we've been kind of a bated breath, wondering, will there be a replacement? And day before yesterday, it was noted that there is a pair has returned, so that previously endangered species is intact. It is a second nesting pair in Des Moines, and it's something to look forward to. It's on the east side of the Capitol for those that would want to go down and enjoy these birds. So that's our phenology.
Thank you. And if I understand, there's kind of an added perk to this, which is that if there's a falcon living on the newly renovated Capitol building, that there's going to be less pigeons
Oh, yeah.
Making
real good point.
Pooping on the building because they don't like to live near falcons, right?
Right. Pigeons leave. So that's our phenology for today.
Thank you, Pat, for talking about falcons with us. It's quite an amazing bird, and it's pretty wonderful that they are inhabiting our state capital.
It is very uplifting. There's a lot of environmental challenges. The falcons are guiding us to do better.
Mm-hmm. KHOI is moving forward quickly now with studio construction, and I want to give you a brief update on that before we move on in the show. We did receive a generous donation from an anonymous donor a while back for construction costs. We've been moving forward with many volunteers who've been building the space, which is going to be our broadcast and recording space, under the leadership of our board member, Joe Lynch. Thank you, Joe, for all your work. It's really a dramatic repurposing of this old dry cleaners building. We love the Pantorium, and we are very thankful to everybody who has volunteered building this beautiful new space, including Integrity Construction, who provided the architectural drawing for the space. So as we draw close to moving into the studios, I recorded a short interview with Carlos Torres Sanchez, who is a wall finisher, whose skilled labor was donated to us by Woodruff Construction to push us over the top. And it really has made a difference. In the process, we gained a new friend and listener, hopefully. Let's listen to Carlos's impression of KHOI. I'm here with Carlos Torres Sanchez.
Mm-hmm.
Carlos is with Woodruff Construction Company. Welcome.
Thanks a lot. My pleasure. Because I'm very glad to be help the community station radio.
You've been part of the KHOI team now?
Like 3 days.
So this is basically an update about KHOI as well. Carlos has been working on finishing the walls of KHOI's broadcast and recording studios. We were contacted by Woodruff Construction with an offer to provide some help getting our studios done. And we asked Woodruff Construction why they decided to send help. The statement they sent us was that Woodruff Construction loves being part of the Ames community and has been a proud volunteer at KHOI this past week. With 58 years of construction experience across the state of Iowa, Woodruff knows how to deliver quality work on time and on budget.
That's right.
They also say about you, Carlos. Carlos has been with Woodruff since 2007, and we are lucky to have him. He is a very skilled person at his job, and you can tell how skilled he is. We agree.
Well, I try to do my best in every single work that I do, because always I say something. The work speaks for you. I want to say something about Woodruff. I'm happy to work for Woodruff because Woodruff entrained me and then trained people to do a quality work. I mean, we do a little bit about everything. We do concrete, we do carpenter, we do drywalls, we do all kind of stuff. They make buildings from the beginning, from the bottom to the top, all of them. So you learn a little bit about everything. So that's a good thing. Woodruff opened the door to a lot of people, college guys, to be working with them. And
so you say they trained you. Did you know anything about carpentry when you started working with them?
I know a little bit, but they have people to know what they're doing. If you knew, they always trying to teach you. I mean, we have some class to teach people to do a good work, to do a quality work, and then that's great. I mean, a lot of companies don't do that, but Woodruff, they always provide everything to be a good employer. I'm glad to work for Woodruff, Trisha.
Describe a little bit what you did here at KHOI.
What I do in here is finish all the walls to make sure they look nice.
When you say finish the walls, what does that mean exactly?
The walls was ready, right there.
And what condition were they in?
You sure you want me to say the truth?
Yeah.
I like to be honest in that way. The walls was right there, but it was look kind of terrible, probably. When I'm saying my point, trying to make look good, trying to fixing every single spot that I think was not right, because when I started a job, I want to feel happy what I do.
So the walls were drywalls, right?
Yeah.
And what did you do to the drywall to finish it?
I put tape in. I give the first call. I mean, you had to make look kind of right, wait for dry, and then give the second call to look medium. Third call, I mean, it's going to look like nice. Like, I don't say like perfect, but 99% probably is the wall is ready to go to paint. I mean, it's something that you guys, people can say, I like how they look. I mean, this is what I want to hear. Because if I do something wrong, something don't look nice, I'm going to feel bad. I said, that cannot happen. I cannot do that kind of work. So I want to do something right, mm-hmm. and I know you guys going to be happy, and I'm going to be happy, and I know the company is going to be happy. So I like to take care of my work. what I'm doing. So
you're proud of your workmanship?
Yeah.
You want to leave something behind that you're proud of?
Yeah, I always, every single place that I go, I would like to say somebody asks, who do this work? I say, Carlos, yes, I did it.
How many rooms did you work in?
One, two, three room plus the hallway, plus the wall. I mean, you can say like four probably.
Plus the wall facing the front of the room.
Yeah. Yes, what I'm going to do right now is do some touch-up. Trying to find a little details, like if I have some scratch, I need to go and mark it with pencil, and then I need to go back and check in every single wall to make sure it's okay for painting, you know, and then sand and ready to go.
So the next thing is to paint it.
Yeah.
Right? So then it'll be finished.
It'll be finished, yeah.
And then we put the door frame on and the baseboard.
The baseboard and the trim around. And then
it's finished.
Ready to go.
So we're close to having a finished room.
Yep, it's very close. I think it's very, very, very nice.
So the space feels good.
Yeah, the space feels good.
Yeah, we agree. Mm-hmm. We think that space is very nice.
I think it's wonderful. Uh-huh. I think it's great.
So you really provided a lot of energy and expertise to bring what has been a volunteer project where a lot of people have spent a lot of time.
That's right.
And really bringing it up to a professional standard.
Mm-hmm.
And we thank you for that.
I think it's very nice to people to help the community because we're part of the community. I think it's very nice of a Woodruff Construction to help. I'm here because Woodruff sent me to do this job. Glad to be doing with all my heart.
We thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And we agree. The work is beautiful.
Thanks a lot.
It's very, very beautiful. We've also enjoyed having you here as a person. We've enjoyed meeting you.
Appreciate it.
What do you think of us?
Once in a while, one come inside, looking around, and say they told me it's beautiful, it looked nice. I mean, they make me feel good because I really they give me more energy to try to do better work because I know you guys like it. I know I'm gonna like it, so you guys like it, I'm gonna feel right.
What do you think of the radio operation?
I think it's okay. We hope in the future it'll get bigger, but it's why the community is trying to help in to be a better station radio. So that was gonna happen because everybody gonna put something, you know, little by little, we can make a big place.
Yeah.
So I think it's whoever listen, I think they can donate more money to this station radio, keep going forward for the community. I think it's very good because it's not for only for one person, it's for the whole city. I mean, it's for a lot of people that we can take advantage of this, I mean, in a good way.
One of the things that we ended up discussing with you was the possibility of some Mexican and other South American music, possibly, from the way you speak, you're from a Spanish-speaking country. Can you tell us just a little bit about where you originated from?
I'm from Mexico, of course, from Mexico. I'm here and everywhere from Mexico.
But you've been in the United States been in Iowa for a long time.
A long time, when I was little.
Mm-hmm. But you still have an interest in Mexican music?
Oh, yeah, of course. The Mexican music, like everybody know from the mariachi music. I mean, it's the music who represent basically the country. You're going to receive a lot of phone calls to asking for that kind of music from a lot of, like, explosion right away.
So there's enough Spanish-speaking people in the area to respond to a show like that?
I think so, yeah.
We can start to make contact with that part of the community and, you know, learn more about people who are Spanish-speaking.
That's nice. And all the Latinos, I think they're very available to help the community. When we help something, we do with our heart because we like to help the community.
Well, thank you. We really, really appreciate the work you've done.
My pleasure.
Woodruff asked whether they could let folks know that they're actually looking to hire more people. So they sent us a statement saying, if you'd like to join the Woodruff team, Woodruff is currently hiring, and please apply in person. 515-232-4535. That's 515-232-4535 to call Woodruff, and we will be posting the website on our own website if people are interested in finding that. As Carlos said, Woodruff does train people very carefully.
Yep.
So it's an opportunity for somebody to learn about construction.
Yeah, if you don't know about construction, I mean, they always, somebody's available to train you to how to frame, train you how to hand drywall, all kind of stuff. They have a lot of patience to us, I mean, because they want to be a good company.
So you feel it's a good work environment?
Oh, yeah. Woodruff, I think, is a great opportunity to be work for them.
Where is Woodruff located?
It's in here in Ames, by the 13th Street.
We've been speaking with Carlos Torres Sanchez, who is an employee of Woodruff Construction. Woodruff sent Carlos here. The company has paid him to help us finish our broadcast studios, taken us from a volunteer operation to a professional operation, and the studios are looking really beautiful, and we're really looking forward to moving into the studios.
Yes, soon.
And we're really looking forward to continuing to know you, Carlos. Thank you for coming.
My pleasure.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate it.
Bye.
Once again, for those of you just tuning in, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host for today, Rebecca Brown, and Michael Martin has joined us here at KHOI. Hello.
Hello, Rebecca.
Michael is an associate professor of the Landscape Architecture Program at Iowa State University, and he is here to tell us about the Savannah Studios. Landscape architecture students take Savannah Studios, one of their studios, correct?
Yes. When a student enters the program, after they've completed the core year or the freshman year in the design college, they choose a major, and the ones who are in landscape architecture, this is the first thing they do.
And for those of you that don't know what a studio is, a studio is a group of students who kind of stick together for a semester to have a similar hands-on design experience in a particular theme or discipline. So in the Savannah Studio, students travel all over the Midwest? Where exactly do they travel to?
Well, I should explain the name. Savannah is not the city Savannah, but the Savannah ecotone, which is the middle of the country between the Great Plains and the eastern deciduous forest. So Iowa is smack in the middle of the Savannah. And the original concept is that the students would be exploring landscape and, you know, experiencing it in person by traveling north and south all through the Savannah, which would stretch from Manitoba all the way down to Texas. And so we did that for a few years. We've done 14 of these now, one each year in the fall. And most recently, we've gone a lot further west and further southeast with the trip because we've tried to get into different places with the students.
What's the point of traveling all over creation?
That's a good question. It was the point was experiential learning. So the idea is that the students are going to be landscape architects, are going to be designing in all kinds of contexts and needing to understand the world that they're designing within. And so we want to go to urban places and wild places and national parks and small towns and all sorts of things. And they're learning about design, but they're learning about ecology and plants and so forth. So it's much better for them to be learning in place as opposed to learning, you know, in the classroom for this sort of thing.
Are they camping or staying in hotels?
Both. Alternately. It's roughly, you know, three nights of each. We'll do a hotel and then we'll in a city and then we'll go out to a park or something and camp. And so, yeah, they kind of rough it sometimes.
Do you go to different places every year?
We have
a different set of places every year.
We have certain routes that we go. This last time, we went a place we'd never been before on Savannah, which is to go down to my part of the country where I grew up, which is southeast. I'm from Georgia. Ooh. So we made it all the way to Jekyll Island on the Georgia coast.
And what'd you guys do there?
We were on the beach while you guys were shoveling snow. It was great.
Excellent. What are the students getting from this experience? I mean, other than, you know, learning how to be landscape architects,
yeah,
like some of the moral experiences?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you ask that. The students are in five vans driving all over the country with, there were 34 students and three faculty this last time. And so they're away from home, and so they're having to deal with that. They're also learning how to get along with each other, and kind of they tend to form a kind of a community around this, and, you know, friendships that endure throughout school and beyond. They're also taking four different courses. So there's the design studio, which is basically about designing and understanding design. And then there's a plants class. There is a class on cultural landscapes, or the relationship between culture and landscape. And then there's a class that has to do with construction technologies and what landscape engineering on a kind of a basic level.
Okay. And what about the teachers? Are teachers getting anything from all this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's a fantastic thing. I've done four of these now. There have been 14, but I didn't start doing it until my kids were a little bit older and my wife was okay with me being gone 6 weeks out of the fall. But no, we're great, getting a great deal out of it. To be able to teach in these environments is unlike anything I've ever done, and it's been a tremendous thing for us. We are part of that community, you know, that the students form. I think the professors and the students together are really are a learning community, and that's there's great benefits to that.
So you went this past year,
mm-hmm.
then?
This past fall.
What was your favorite memory from this past fall?
Probably being back in the Atlanta area where I'm from, and Stone Mountain, Georgia, and Jekyll Island and all this. These were places that I used to go with my family when I grew up in Georgia. And so to be able to go back there and then, you know, have this kind of local expert quality that I could convey to all the students, I think that was really special. Brought back a lot of memories for me, too.
That's good. Memories are always kind of fun. And when you're in old places, back at home sort of thing.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, I was in the College of Design as well, and whenever...
I remember that.
Whenever the LA students, our little anagram for landscape architecture is LA, I always heard stories of, you know, people not showering for weeks and weeks and come back all stinky.
Yeah.
Does that add to the experience? You know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it's funny because I remember the first Savannah I went on, we ended the first camping stop was Badlands National Park, which is where we were camping anyway, is quite primitive. And I remember that we got out of the vans and a couple of the female students came up to us and said, "So where are the showers?" And not only did they not have showers, they didn't even have bathrooms. I mean, so it was, and then, but you know, they rolled with it and everybody gets through it. Sometimes some of our students have never camped before, ever. You know, they just don't have, they didn't grow up in families that camped. And so, yeah, it's a real experience for them. But I think, it's really admirable how they get through it and how they actually come to kind of enjoy it. And sometimes it's tough. It was really cold in the Tetons this past, I guess it was October that we were there. Mm. And so it can get a little bit uncomfortable at times.
You just kind of stick with it.
Yep.
What are your like top five, you know, favorite trips? If you had to rank all the ones you've been on, you know,
top five, that's good. Yeah, this is like that movie High Fidelity. Top five. Top five, I would say cities, the cities that are really great to go to with these guys, Denver is especially good, and Minneapolis is also a really great destination because there's so much there. There's, you know, they're interesting as historical places, but also the new stuff that's been designed, you know, the contemporary works of landscape architecture. I would say wild places. I love Yellowstone. We've been there a few times, and we were at Biltmore, which is the huge Vanderbilt mansion in Nashville, North Carolina. We went there with the group this past time, and that was phenomenal. So that's four, isn't it? I got one more to go. There's so many. Oh, probably Boundary Waters, which is, mm-hmm. you know, north Minnesota on the border of Canada. I've only done that once, but that was amazing because when you're there, it's like you're on another planet. You know, you're totally out of touch with everything. So that was quite marvelous.
So even though this is for students, you know, if you had to give the community one last word about what they could take away from the story about Savannah, how can this influence the community in some way?
Well, I think what it has taught me about teaching is that that teaching in places, if you're teaching anything, that there's just no substitute for actually being there. And there's also this idea of getting out of a classroom and being outside. So I think whatever you're teaching, it doesn't have to do anything with landscape. You know, being able to focus students in a place. So, you know, get them outside, you know, take advantage of the world around you. And the learning experience is sometimes because of that very, very much deeper.
Well, thank you, Michael, for joining us this morning.
Thank you,
and,
Rebecca.
This is part of my little mini-series about traveling Iowans and how they've been affected with the wanderlust. And
come back and do a station ID for us with a voice like that.
Oh, I'd love to.
You got a voice for radio.
Yes, a face for radio, too.
All right. We'll take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Thank you. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we just spoke with Michael Martin from the ISU Department of Design, part of Rebecca's ongoing travel series, Iowans in Travel. And the music we just were listening to was by Washem, a musical venture from Jerusalem that expressed the spirit of Palestine. And thank you, Betsy Mayfield, for providing the music. For the rest of the hour, we will, in fact, be turning our attention to Palestine.
We're going to be commemorating the anniversary of the death of the activist Rachel Corrie. Rachel was a young woman whose quest for peace took her to Palestine. You will learn the story of a young woman with Midwestern values and influences, and she was a normal young person with extraordinary sympathy for other people of other side of the world. And here are Rachel's parents, Cynthia and Craig Corrie.
We're here today with the Corrie family, Cynthia and Craig, from Olympia, Washington. So pleased to have you with us.
Thank you for having us.
It's great to be here.
Yeah. We're recognizing the 11th anniversary of the death of your daughter. Could you give us some background on your daughter, and then we'll explore some other topics?
Sure. Rachel was our third child. She grew up here in Olympia, Washington, where Craig and I are still living. And she was a college student here at the Evergreen State College. She had completed her coursework. She had become very interested in the Middle East. I think she was always interested in the world. I know she was always interested in the world. And she had some great world experiences before her death. But she became very interested in the Middle East, particularly after 9/11. Happened here in the U.S. Like a lot of people, she was looking for explanations for that. And being here at the college level, a lot of attention was focused in that direction. And as the U.S. turned to war as a response to 9/11, Rachel and a lot of people in this community were looking at other possibilities, and there were new peace groups that were formed, the Olympia Movement for Justice and Peace, Olympians for Peace in the Middle East, and then Rachel reconnected with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which has been active here for decades. And through all of that, her attention really was drawn to Israel and Palestine as being, you know, not a sole cause, but certainly a factor in a lot of discontent in the world about U.S. policy and actions. And as a result of that, she was part of a student group on campus that formed students, educating students about the Middle East. She had friends who traveled to Israel and Palestine in 2002. There had been a move to bring a human rights monitoring force to the region during that period because it was a violent time in Israel and in Palestine. And so there had been this resolution in the United Nations brought by the High Commissioner of Human Rights, and it was vetoed by the United States. And at that point, there were activists, Israeli, Palestinian, and American, who started what was called the International Solidarity Movement. And the idea was to bring people from around the world who would join in solidarity with Palestinians who were facing a great deal of threat, but were challenging what was happening to them through nonviolent resistance. And some of Rachel's friends traveled to Palestine in 2002, were in the West Bank. One friend had gone to Gaza. They came back and there was a call for more people to come and join this effort. And she made the decision to do that. In January of 2003, she traveled through Ben Gurion Airport and then to the West Bank for training with the International Solidarity Movement. She had made a choice to go to Gaza. That was before she left here, because she had heard that that's where the need was greatest. And at that time there were massive home demolitions that were occurring on the border between Egypt and Gaza, the southern border of the Gaza Strip. And it was the Israeli military that was doing the home demolitions. They had control of what was to be a small, narrow corridor between Egypt and Gaza. It's called the Philadelphia Corridor. But for their military reasons, they kept expanding that. And the way that they did that was to destroy the homes of civilian families. Human Rights Watch has a report that came out in 2004 that said that a tenth of the population of Rafah lost their homes, and mostly without military necessity. And there was no compensation for these families, and it was a terribly difficult time. So Rachel and other international activists from the UK, from really all over the world, came to Gaza. They were able to enter through Israel at that time, through Erez checkpoint into Gaza. And Rachel was there for not quite 2 months. She did a lot of things, working with children, with families, staying with families whose homes were threatened, but also gathering information for human rights organizations about what was happening in different parts of the Gaza Strip. She was a writer always, and so she really opened our eyes and with her writings home to us about what she was seeing. She was really interested in building connections and thinking about how she could continue connections with the people she was getting to know in the Gaza Strip once she returned home. And then on March 16th of 2003, so it'll be 11 years ago on Sunday, she and a group of the activists, there were seven others from the UK and from the US, were called to this area where so many homes had been destroyed. There were two bulldozers that had appeared in the area. Each of those bulldozers had two people inside, and an Israeli armored personnel carrier with the commander on the ground was in that carrier at the time. And they were pushing on structures. They were operating in this area where there were homes where people felt threatened. So the activists went all afternoon. They were challenging those bulldozers by standing, showing that they were not going to move from between the bulldozers and the homes that were there. Rachel was wearing a bright orange jacket. The activists thought they had been successful that day in preventing home demolition. But then it was late in the afternoon, about 5 o'clock, the bulldozers had retreated towards the border area. The activists had called their coordinator to say they thought that the military was moving away at that point. But then one of the bulldozers made a run towards a house where Rachel had stayed. She knew the family inside the house. She knew that they were behind the wall. And she took her position. And the bulldozer, even though at other times they had come up and stopped actually right at the feet of the activist, this time the bulldozer proceeded ahead over Rachel. Her friends were hollering and screaming and for the bulldozer to stop. It stopped, but then backed over her again. She was there with, you know, activist friends that we now know personally, people that cared about her a great deal. She said to them, "I think my back is broken." And those were her last words. She died soon after.
This is certainly tragic murder that we have to experience. And how has it been that the foundation has carried on Rachel Corey's work?
Well, after Rachel was killed, we started a foundation that people wanted to do something, I think, and then started sending us money. And then we talked to a woman whose daughter was killed in South Africa. So Linda Beale's daughter, Amy Beale, was killed trying to sign up those first Black South Africans for the election, you know, right before they ended apartheid, or in part of ending apartheid, and her daughter was killed, and she had started a foundation. We met her, and so she kind of put that spark in us, and so we started it, and along with some friends from around Olympia, and then just people come on and support it. So Cindy and I are full-time volunteers. Cindy's far more than full-time volunteer at the foundation, but we've been working, trying to really pull people together to get, I think, people to think about what we consider the other in a very human terms, because I think once we become friendly and know people from different parts of the world, or just different situations in our own part of the world, we figure out that they're really much more like us and than we think, maybe, and that with that knowledge, we, you know, it becomes much harder to hurt somebody in that way. And I think that that's one way on a grassroots level to pull people together, and then hopefully make that change our governments.
Yes, in the name of patients. Could you give do you have a website? How can listeners contact your foundation?
We certainly have a website, and we would love for people to go and check it out, and also to be in contact with us if they have questions or interest. It's www.rachelcoreyfoundation.org, and Rachel is RachelCorrie foundation.org.
And we're visiting with Cynthia and Craig Corey from Olympia, Washington, previous Iowans. Would you give us a little background on your upbringing here in Iowa?
Well, I'm from central Iowa, so I lived in Des Moines, Iowa. I went to Roosevelt High School on the west side of Des Moines, and Cindy and I both went to Drake University. That's where we met. I would say I pretty much lived just north of town. My grandfather grew up on a farm in Prairie City, I think, just east of Des Moines, and spent most of half of his life trying to get off the farm, and then the last half of his life trying to get back onto a farm. So he was an attorney in Des Moines, and every Friday he'd drive around picking up his grandchildren and taking us out to this 80 acres we had. What now would be just, what, southeast of where the Sailor Bell Dam is. He had horses and he had woods and all that sort of thing. So that's where I spent my time. My weekends and my summers were pretty much spent on this 80 acres and the woods that was around that. Probably. Just exploring and
along the Des Moines River.
Yeah, right. Looks really out towards the Des Moines River. It was, if you wanted to mail him a letter, it would have gone to Ankeny. I think still that's true.
Sure.
And I'm from western Iowa, originally from Denison. I grew up on a farm. My brother still farms our family farm and some more land in that area. And we feel very, very connected to Iowa. My siblings are spread across the state. I have siblings in Iowa City and in Denison. we have friends, college friends still. So I often say I need every so often to have my Iowa fix to go back and check in. And Craig and I like to drive across the state. We live out here where it's very beautiful, where we have mountains and Puget Sound, and we feel so blessed in our natural surroundings here. But we're also very rooted in Iowa, so we love the Iowa landscape and our opportunities to be there.
And you mentioned Rachel's writings and some of your trips back to Iowa. Tell us about Rachel's book, Let Me Stand Alone.
Rachel was a writer all of her life, really. She was a kid sort of sitting in the corner, either drawing or a little later on writing. And so she kept journals and other sorts of writing, and or sometimes she lost journals, as she put it. But anyway, after she was killed, we put together a lot of her writing and into a book. And it, as you said, it's called Let Me Stand Alone. It's published by Norton, and I think you can still find it in various places or order it.
It's an excellent read. For all the listeners, it's an excellent read. It embodies a lot of the Midwestern values. I noticed that quite often the environment comes up. Her love of family is very well expressed. But it was from these journals that I understand some playwrights were very impressed.
Alan Rickman, who is an actor that some of your audience may be familiar with, I know the younger audiences particularly know him as Snape in the Harry Potter films. He lives in London. At the time that Rachel was killed, one of the things that had impacted our family so much were her letters from Gaza. It's amazing to me, having traveled to that region now, and I find personally that it's really hard to take the time when you're experiencing so many new and sometimes very difficult things to then make the time to write. But she did that, and she saw that as part of her responsibility, I think, to be able to communicate what she was witnessing. So she would spend hours in an internet cafe. It wasn't an easy matter. It's not like picking up computers like we do here. She had to go to an internet cafe, and the electricity had to work and all that kind of thing to make it happen. But she sent some really important emails home to us and to her friends. And after she was killed, we made the decision, because she wanted so much to get the word out, that we would make those available. They were read by editors of the Guardian newspaper in the UK. And within days after Rachel was killed, we had messages from them saying that they would like to use some of them to print some of her writing in the Guardian, because they had not seen anything for a very long time that so personalized and so humanized what was happening in Gaza. And then and we gave that permission right away. They then called back and said they really would like to run all the emails, and they did that over the course of 2 days in March. I think it's March 17th and March 19th. It's still, if people go to The Guardian and Google Rachel Corey, March 2003, you can find what was printed. Alan Rickman, the actor, was presented with that writing by a friend of his, and he, after reading it, took it to the Royal Court Theatre, which is a very well-known theatre in London, and said to them, we need to try to do something with this work. And the Royal Court contacted our family. I was, my AOL email account crashed with messages coming from all around the world, very quickly. But my son, who's a tech person, got us fixed up, even though our family was, of course, dealing with the incredible, really, trauma of what had happened. But my sisters, I'm so fortunate to have a big Iowa family, because my sisters and my brother all came to help us. And one of my sisters saw the message about from the Royal Court Theater, and she lives in Ashland, Oregon, and she went and inquired about this theater locally, and they said, and was told that it was just an excellent place. So she responded back to them. They had written and sent condolences, and then just said that at some point they would be interested in talking about doing something with that writing.
And it was produced.
Well, what they did then was eventually they met Craig and me. We came through London after having gone to the Middle East for the first time later that year. It was about 6 months after Rachel was killed, and Ellen Rickman was in the room, and they just said that they didn't say they were going to create a play. They just said that they do work, they did workshops and that kind of thing, and that they'd be interested in exploring what might happen. And we told them we had more writing, but we failed to get it to them right away. Later, our daughter Sarah was making a trip with us to the UK. We ran into Ellen Rickman again, apologized for not getting writing to them, but said, and Sarah, our daughter, said, I'll get it to you. And she did that. She went through tubs of what we had, things I had saved through the years from Rachel, yeah, sitting in those corners drawing and writing.
And what a production. And what a...
They created then this play, eventually, My Name is Rachel Corey, which has been in Des Moines recently. We were lucky to be there in January to see a marvelous production, and also has been throughout the world.
And I can't help but wonder that this is not the last of the Rachel Corey productions here in Iowa or around the world. It seems to be growing. How do you feel about this continued interest in your daughter's work?
I don't know whether it's growing, but it's certainly still, it's amazing to me that it still keeps going, because I think we've seen it in different parts of the United States maybe 4 or 5 times in the last year, and that's just when we've been able to be there. So I know they were putting it, last weekend it was in Portland, Maine, and there are a few other places. In fact, there's going to be a person doing excerpts of it out here in Olympia this Sunday. So it's pretty amazing. I think it's a powerful piece. It's very difficult to do, and at the Royal Court Theater, I remember sort of as it closed down one of its early runs in London, and it did win 2 or 3 awards in London, which is not a shabby place to be winning theater awards. But anyway, at the Royal Court Theater, one of the women said you know, that young women would be using this to try out for auditions for plays for decades to come, and that may be, but what we see now is young women that I think read it, it appeals to them, and they want to do it. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, In the Name of Peace is an incredible production. I think we probably have time for one more story, or just when times are tough, are there any special Rachel Corey moments that you draw upon?
You know, well, the one that I remember particularly at this time of year, I guess, is my last visit here in Olympia, because Craig had a job change. We were living in North Carolina when Rachel was killed, even though this is really our home now in Olympia. When I came in the door at flying home to spend some time with Rachel and with her sister Sarah, I walked into the living room, and that's where I'm sitting right now, and she came through the door. I guess I was here, and she came through the door, and she just wrapped her arms around me and held me for about 5 minutes, it felt like. And when I think about it, I just think of this long hug. No words passed between us, but we just embraced, because we were so glad to be with one another and be in that same space again. And it's a comfort to me, actually, to hold on to that moment.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
Glad to.
Well, it's certainly a privilege and an honor to be a part of this production for KHOI Community Radio. You've certainly enriched our lives, and I want to thank you very much.
Thank you for
thank
the
you.
Opportunity.
And next time in Iowa, please let's get together for coffee.
That would be wonderful.
Awesome.
We'd love it.
I'd love it. I'd look forward to it. Thank you.
Our guest today has been Cynthia and Craig Corey, the parents of activist Rachel Corey, who was killed defending a Palestinian home in the Gaza Strip. March 16th will be the 11th anniversary of her passing.
We also spoke with Carlos Torres Sanchez from Woodruff Construction, who has finished our studio walls. Thank you, Carlos, and thank you, Woodruff Construction, for your donation and support of Community Radio.
Then Michael Martin Associate Professor of the Landscape Architecture Program in the ISU College of Design.
We've been your three hosts for today, Ursula Rudenberg, Pat Larbaum, and Becca Brown. Rebecca is also our engineer today. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard The Hero by Washam from their CD called Ashira. We also heard Find the Cost of Freedom from the album Four-Way Street by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young.
You can also listen to this show and all our past Local Talk shows online on our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org, where you'll find an archive for all the Local Talk shows we've produced since we went on the air in 2012 on our website. Recent shows will be posted on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, can get the information. There you will find lists of our guests and links to the organizations and other resources mentioned on our shows.
We'd like to hear your feedback either by phone at 515-292-2878 or by email at khoiradio@gmail.com with news in the subject line.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show, and if you'd like to join the team as a reporter, please contact us. We'll train you. The number is 292-2878 or email at khoiradio@gmail.com. We'd like to thank again everybody who came to Ames Trivia Night. We had a fabulous night. We had more than 200 people there, and it was a lot of fun, and we raised money for KHOI and NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. Your participation as our audience, as always, is what makes KHOI possible. So thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.
This is your KHOI community calendar for events occurring from Saturday, March 15th to Friday, March 21st, 2014. On Saturday, March 15th, there will be a pancake breakfast held at the Iowa Arboretum from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. Kevin Lands and family members of the Arboretum will be making scrumptious pancakes for the day for you to eagerly chow down. Attend the event hungry and challenge Kevin to make special pancakes for you. The Iowa Arboretum is located at 1875 Peach Avenue in Madrid. You can visit www.iowaarboretum.org for more information or call 515-795-3216. Great books. Okay, on Sunday, March 16th, there will be a book group from 2 to 4 p.m. at Northcrest Community discussing literary classics using the anthology Great Conversation 6 from the Great Books Foundation. This month, A Letter Concerning Toleration by John Locke will be discussed. To sign up for this series, visit the library's information desk or call 515-239-5656. Northcrest Community with the Ames Public Library is located at 1801 20th Street in Ames. Enjoy a good read. Monday, March 17th is St. Patrick's Day. Enjoy that corned beef and cabbage. And as always, be careful driving if you decide to imbibe in some of those ales. Enjoy! Nevada Food at First serves a free dinner to the community from Sunday to Friday at 5:30 p.m. and Saturday lunch at 11:30 a.m. at the First United Methodist Church in Nevada at 1036 7th Street. Call 515-382-6536 for more information. The Ames Food at First also serves dinner every day except Wednesday at the First United Methodist Church at 516 Kellogg with access on 6th Street. Contact Chris Martin, their director, at the Food at First helpline, 515-344-HELP or 515-344-4357. Listeners who are inclined to help others less fortunate are encouraged to go to the website of the United Way of Story County, where many donated useful daily necessities gathered from those who have and no longer need and are available for those who need them. Food pantries, rent and utility assistance, clothing and furniture, medical and housing resources, counseling and support programs, preschool and child care contacts, and much more are available. Contact the United Way of Story County at 315 Clark Avenue in Ames, 515-268-5142. You can also visit uwstory.org. Okay, on Wednesday, March 19th, Heartland Senior Services will have a jazz jam from 7 to 9 p.m. at 205 South Walnut Avenue in Ames. Listen to a variety of music and do some line dancing and just have fun. You can visit www.heartlandseniorservices.com or dial 515-233-2906 for more information. Heartland Senior Services has the jazz jam on the first Friday and third Wednesday of every month. Seniors are also invited to a country jam, which is on Friday, March 21st from 7 to 10 p.m., which is also located at the Heartland Senior Services in Ames. Develop your speaking and leadership skills with Ames Toastmasters, held every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. at City Hall, Room 215, at 515 Clark Avenue in Ames. All visitors are welcome. Increase your confidence and meet fun, friendly people in a relaxed environment. See what Toastmasters is all about. Visit ames.toastmastersclubs.org for more information. This has been your KHOI Community Calendar for the week. I'm Elizabeth Kutiepov. Thanks for listening. And remember to pledge your support to KHOI Community Radio. Thanks again.